Larry Burns has been the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, better known as COHA, since its founding in 1975. A former defense researcher, strategist, and member of the Institute for Strategic Studies in London and the All Souls College, Oxford's military seminar, he was a senior grade public affairs officer for the UN Economic Commission for Latin America in Santiago, Chile. Burns also taught and lectured for 15 years in the fields of Latin American studies, comparative government, and international law at a number of U.S. and British colleges and universities. He has been interviewed on just about every network news program here and abroad, and his views on Latin America have been published widely in the U.S. as well as Latin America. And he's been a guest on my program several times, but not for quite a while. Anyway, that's the abbreviated version of a much longer bio. As they say, he knows his stuff. It's been quite a while since we last spoke, so I'm truly pleased to welcome once again Larry Burns to Takes on the World. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, indeed.
Well, these much is happening. These last 4 days were to have been a much heralded alliance and trade-building trip for President Obama to Latin America. But another war in the Middle East seems to have not only relegated news coverage of the trip to the inside pages of the New York Times, but even caused him to cut the trip short by a few hours. But why was President Obama's trip so important, and what was the significance of the countries that he visited?
Well, I of course, don't really know why he chose certain countries. They wouldn't be the countries that I would have chosen. In terms of the significance, U.S.-Latin American relations are in big trouble, and we thought that they might get a fix when, during 2 years ago, when during the Obama campaign, he came forth with some positive remarks about new beginnings in Latin America, and that he would devote himself in a significant manner to that region. It turned out that nothing of the sort took place. And what the president did do is to come forth with a kind of a jerry-built program of allowing Cuban Americans to travel to Cuba, but not Americans, only Cuban Americans, and by lifting restrictions on remittances of funds by family members in the United States back to Cuba. I mean, those were progressive gestures, but they certainly were a disappointment because that's where his initiative stopped. And in fact, things got worse, and I think that Secretary of State Clinton deserves a good deal of blame for this, is that she positioned Washington when the Honduran coup occurred a number of months ago. Instead of standing in unison with the other Latin American countries in condemning this extra-constitutional overthrow of a democratically elected government, she basically, together with the State Department's Inter-American Bureau, they legitimated what the oligarchy was doing in Honduras, which Brazil, amongst others, furiously lashed out at the United States for not being devoted to the kinds of rulings and legislation which had supported as a member of the Organization of American States. So this trip was meant to rehabilitate U.S. Latin American relations. It was also a recognition that there are a lot of Latinos living in this country, and certainly Salvador, with 2 million Salvadoran refugees living in the United States, many of them in California. He felt it was good politics to begin to move around. The trip itself turned out to be not much to do about nothing, and I think the gains were modest and incremental, and I think that the United States is going to have to work much harder if it wants to renovate its relations with the region.
Well, he had a number of differences with President Lula, and now Lula has been replaced by a former, actually, political prisoner who seems to be much more willing to cooperate, or not that Lula didn't, De Silva did not cooperate with the United States, but in certain positions, and vis-a-vis Iran, for example, he took very strong stands against the U.S.
And most recently, he abstained, along with Germany and Russia and China, on the no-fly zone. He did not. His Brazilian foreign policy was against, or at least abstained on that issue.
So what I saw on the television, some nice kind of social getting together between the two of them, but what was gained, do you think, if anything, from that trip to Brazil?
Well, Brazil is right now undergoing a kind of monumental process of shedding the definition of being the sleeping giant of Latin America to a new definition, which is an emerging superpower. And one of the reasons why Brazil is so formidable a nation is that historically, the Latin American countries were at a disadvantage to the United States when it came to the terms of trade, that is, for to buy a given locomotive. The average Latin American country had to pay with more and more bushels of corn because its standard of living and its currency was always behind that of the United States. Well, in recent years, with the advent of China and India and Russia all becoming major consumer nations, all of a sudden, mirabile dictu, what we had was a shortage of commodities worldwide, and the price of food skyrocketed, and Brazil, being the second largest country producer of soy, for example, found itself in an extremely advantageous position, and its foreign currency accounts began to swell, and these countries became less and less inclined to be dependent upon the United States and more inclined to initiate their own relations with a diversity of nations, some of whom Washington considered to be pariahs, international pariahs, like North Korea, like Iran, like Libya. And so all of a sudden, Brazil, which had always deferred to the United States, now was developing its own independent agenda. President Lula traveled to different parts of the world, including in Venezuela, where Lula went repeatedly. It seemed whenever Lula was in trouble in terms of his leftist credentials back in Brazil, and his fellow workers' party militants felt that he was too eager to court the United States and the bourgeois, he would go to Caracas, Venezuela, and there he would hug Chavez, and Chavez would hug him back, and that bear hug diplomacy gave a lot of political clout to each one of the participants. But Lula, while he performed domestically, initiating all sorts of programs that improved the standard of living of the poor, his foreign policy orientation was never entirely disinterested in U.S. opinion, and the relations between Brazil and the United States were generally more than polite, perhaps less than cordial. Now, the new president, Brazil's first woman president, Dilma, she is actively courting the United States, wants to be good friends with Washington. Now, of course, we don't know where that's going to go, because we don't know whether, now that the president is returning, whether there'll be any kind of lingering interest that he has in the region. Usually, these guys go down there, and they come back, and they forget all about the subject, and Latin America is always moved to the back of the list of agenda items that are very important. But now with Latin America's new emerging status as important regional players, that situation may be changing.
My guest is Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. His trip to Chile also didn't quite go as expected. He was expected to sign, as I understand, an agreement for the United States to help build nuclear reactors for Chile, as earthquake-prone as any place in the world. And this is supposed to be a well-publicized signing appearance photo op, but it was done behind closed doors, and evidently the people, and this happened, of course, during the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, and this was met with, protests against Obama when he arrived in Chile.
Yes, this trip was basically signing inexpensive, relatively low-level partnerships on a whole range of issues. It was almost as if they wanted to make the laundry list as long as possible in order to suggest that this is going to be a revival of U.S. interest. Well, the U.S. has not been particularly interested in Latin America. It was rather interesting that the president went back to that JFK initiative, the Alliance for Progress, in saying we're going to create a new Alliance for Progress here. Well, the Alliance for Progress was not really a very successful initiative. It was underfunded. And normally, for example, when the United States gave money to build roads, the roads, like in Chile, were rather than north-south roads, which is what Chile really needed, they were east-west roads because that's where the American copper mines were. And so this was essentially more aid to U.S. corporations like Kennecott and Anaconda rather than supporting a program that was not particularly wise for Chile to undertake. There are also a lot of these national issues. Like in Chile, there's a raging dispute over the treatment of the Mapuche Indians, the indigenous Indians of the south of Chile. And, of course, Chilean democracy is not entirely untarnished because after the Pinochet was pushed out of governance in 1992. The Democratic Party, the Christian Democratic Party, which in conjunction with several other parties ruled the country for until the last election when the conservative was elected. But these Christian Democrats, these center-left people, did not revoke Pinochet-era regulations or diktats, but use them to essentially break the back of the Chilean labor movement. And so much of the growth of the so-called Chilean economic miracle that occurred at that time was actually as a result of the fact that there was a very ineffective labor movement due to the fact that the labor was hobbled by this retrogressive decrees that had been enacted during the Pinochet era.
Now, how Sebastian Piñera, the new president, is actually to the right of the Christian Democrats. How is the economic situation for workers, labor in Chile, developed or been allowed to develop under his presidency? Has there been any resistance?
Well, you can go both ways on answering this. You can say that there has been a movement from the lower middle class to the center middle class. You certainly have seen a huge concentration of wealth in Chile. That is, in Chile, there are several billionaires, and because there's a lot of money to be made from Chilean wine and Chilean fruits and, of course, copper. and, of course, wood products. The only thing is there are a lot of disputes in Chile, which the Chilean officials don't want you to hear about because they prove somewhat embarrassing to the government. Chile also is a healthy dislike of Chileans throughout Latin America because Chile has always prided itself for being a European nation and without having the heavy Indian adulteration of its blood. Of course, the reason why there hasn't been adulteration is because of the fact that the indigenous population basically have the jobs that the poor in all of Latin America have, which is the hewers of wood and drawers of water. That is only Brazil, really, and of course Venezuela, have societies where the poor and the aboriginal have access to. Latin America has today one of the highest concentrations of wealth in the world. That means that fewer people own more money in Chile and other thriving Latin American countries than any other region on the globe.
You mentioned Venezuela. Of course, in Bolivia and also Ecuador, there's been a more of a movement from the indigenous, or at least it appears that way, in terms of the elections of president in Bolivia and Ecuador. How has that, in fact, played itself out in terms of improving the lives of indigenous people in those countries?
Well, it's important to note at this point that at the present time, the U.S. administration has very harsh feelings towards Chavez, and they diss him whenever they can. Hillary Clinton has been particularly active in doing so. Not that Chavez doesn't have a provocative personality. He certainly does. He's also quite confrontational. But the fact is that Chavez may have violated the spirit of the Constitution, but not the letter. And Venezuela today, there's a very active opposition press. The opposition controls 40% of the legislature. Chavez sometimes doesn't do himself much good by the way he handles himself. But it's basically a question of style more than it is substance. And it also is a fact that Chavez is a genuine socialist and he has a vision of socializing Venezuela. And you may say, well, at the same time, Fidel Castro, several months ago, ridiculed the Cuban economy and said that surely we can do better than we've done for decades and begin to serve our people who have suffered. A lot is changing, but the United States still has an unsatisfactory attitude towards Latin America, and its behavior is still that of a bully boy. It has improved under Obama, but not by very much. And one hopes that this region, which now no longer sees itself as in America's backyard, they say they're in their own front yard, and they have targeted yardism as one of the things that they are going to defiantly reject, because they feel they can engage in relations with any country in the world and experiment with any political system that they want to, and not have Henry Kissinger breathing down their neck.
Well, it's interesting that among the protests that greeted President Obama were protests against the U.S. intervention in Libya. Now, Chavez, Fidel Castro, Daniel Ortega, and some other Latin American leaders have come out against that intervention. How will that play throughout Latin America?
Well, I would say that in general, the interventional, the no-fly zone thesis was very popular in Latin America because a lot of these countries suffered during the 1980s grievous repression under the local local military regimes, like Chile and Argentina, or Brazil. They're all examples of this. And so there's a certain sympathy for Libyan civilians who are suffering at the hands of Gaddafi. At the same time, there's a lot of suspicion of what Washington is up to. It almost seems that Washington is extremely anxious to disengage from Libya because it sees this as being a negative factor in the President Obama's reelection campaign. At the same time, I think there's a lot of split feelings about this. And it took a long time for Chavez, a number of days, for him to work out an acceptable strategy for himself to deal with the developments in Libya. But Chavez is a person of very strong loyalties, and he becomes friends with these guys. He visits them, and they hug, and Libya drops a little change to $200 million credit for and joins up with Venezuela on a number of cooperative partnerships. Chavez is someone we've got to deal with. You either have to assassinate him or you have to deal with him. And unfortunately, the State Department hasn't developed, seems to curry close relations only with those countries that are effusively friendly with Washington, rather than look upon problem children like Venezuela, like Bolivia, like Evo Morales in Bolivia, as targets for U.S. creative diplomacy. We'd like to see more of that and less of these bellicose remarks that the administration makes from time to time. And certainly, I'm looking forward to Secretary of State Clinton's resignation, as she suggested she's going to do, because she's been no great friend of Latin America.
Speaking of that, we're going to go to the phones in a moment, but before we do that, I want to get your take on the return to Haiti of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the position of the U.S. before he returned of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama saying that it would not be advisable.
This is the policy followed by her husband when he was president, which was to marginalize Aristide and prevent him from having political successes. I think it's being continued today. That is, clearly Aristide returned to Haiti with no great approval coming from the United States. And that has always troubled me, because the time I've known Aristide, he too, like Chavez, is a very difficult person. But he was a huge asset to Haitian democracy. He was one of the very few people who was seen as being incorruptible and a person who really represented the poor. Problems with him, but also he was a man of some courage. Right now, Haiti is a zoo, and the people that the United States is dealing with, are not exactly top-draw Democrats. Take, for example, the current president of the country, René Préval. René Préval was a very attractive political personality, a very modest man. He had been a protege of Aristide. They were very close. Well, in last several years, after Préval was elected president, he eventually banned Aristide and his political party from participating in the election, and became a kind of satrap of U.S. policymakers and extremely unpopular back in Haiti. Now, Aristide is a democratic asset, if you look upon it that way. He's a liability if you look upon the future of Haitian politics as being drafted in Washington, which has only wanted one thing from Haiti all along, which is for Haiti to be pushed off the U.S. security agenda because it didn't have to worry about that country any longer. And the United States was never particularly concerned about the quality of democracy that Haiti possessed, only in the appearance that democracy was there, so they could sell the status quo as acceptable.
Well, it certainly he certainly showed that he still has that popularity, and in fact, the two presidential candidates both opposed his return, were not quick to attack him. I'm going to go to the phones now. My guest is Larry Burns, Council of Hemispheric Affairs. Someone has been trying to call for quite a while. Let's go to the phones now and see who this is. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. Yes, thank you for asking about the Aristide. And to further that point, I'm curious, with his triumphant acceptance back into the country, what does that do to U.S. policy in that he was effectively extraordinarily rendition kidnapped to Africa 7 years ago and kept in exile there? And is the U.S. backdooring attempts to manipulate Haiti through the Dominican Republic, which is only separated by a line in the middle of that island, through manipulating the rescue efforts and politically? Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question. Good question.
Well, that man knows about Haiti. Yes, I mean, Aristide is not running for office. That is, the election itself has taken place, a presidential election, and we're waiting for definitive results to come in. I think it'll come in April. That is, there are a lot of people ready to demonstrate in favor of Aristide, and the question how wise Aristide is going to be in conserving his political options and not squandering them on repeated protest demonstrations that could only produce an image that he's come as a spoiler back from an extraordinarily manipulated exile that was the product of U.S. policymakers. Aristide represents an economic, or that is, the United States always feared Aristide because they looked upon him as a Castro wannabe, that we would have another Cuba in Haiti. This was the fear that the administration had. That's why U.S. policy was used as a kind of governor to slow down Aristide's initiatives and prevent him from being the social justice-minded president they wanted to be. And I don't think that history is going to be kind to Bill Clinton. Or in fact, Clinton almost apologized a few weeks ago for some of his policies. I felt it very ironic when Bill Clinton was made the co-head of this friendship committee with Haiti. It was the classic example of
Alice in Wonderland.
I mean, it was just unbelievable that was done. And it's unbelievable that down home boy Clinton must have looked upon this as really a piece of garden humor for him to occupy that position. But there are countries that are in very similar situation to Haiti. Honduras is another example of this. And in fact, the Dominican Republic is a country that is thriving right now, but only some Dominicans are thriving. And many more Dominicans are not thriving. One hopes that with this commodity revolution, with the increased value of sugar and vegetables and fruits that can be grown throughout Latin America, that this is going to have a significant economic consequences for the region, but there has to be policy driving that economic consequence, because if you don't come up with good policies, the status quo is maintained.
Well, thank you. That's our board is lit up. We're going to go to the call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Jeff, I'm enjoying your program very much and your guest, but most importantly, I wanted to say that I thought your remarks introducing the program this morning about Libya and the Middle East were very important. It's Cal calling, you know.
Yeah.
And brave of you to get out there with those positions, and please keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
That's it. Go back.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just tell you there. I was talking in my introduction about what I call the affinity for dictators groups. That's been a problem on many of the left for many decades, as you probably are aware, in which as long as a dictator or a central committee is seen as an opponent of the United States, it's okay. And if the people there have human rights or not that we fight for and cherish, we don't think much of those. So that's what I had mentioned. That's what he was calling about.
Yeah, and I very much adhere to those remarks.
Yeah, I've watched this over the years, and it's a dismal experience. The same people, are saying the U.S. orchestrated all the uprisings in throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And we do have another caller. Let's go to that caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Aristide used the word respect yesterday when he was talking to Amy Goodman on his return to Haiti as the key to the U.S. establishing good relationships with these so-called developing countries. And I use the word these on purpose because I think that perhaps that is one of the directions that we could take in advancing our relationships with those countries, is being very careful about the language that we use. Those people, that country, not good. We have to change that. That's a step in the right direction. For example, saying, Brazil, or talking about Haiti, but never that country, those people, because it separates us, them and us. Mr. Burns is on the right path. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Language is important. One interesting thing I read this morning, Fidel Castro has, you probably saw, you may have seen that Fidel Castro has announced that he had quit as head of the Cuban Communist Party 5 years ago. Hello, Larry?
Yes.
Oh, did you see that?
Yes, I did. Just like I listened to the Amy Goodman interview, I was very much persuaded by some of the remarks that came out during that program. Cuba has come forth, that is, the Castro brothers have come forth with extraordinarily venturesome new positions on a whole variety of subjects. In fact, Fidel Castro directly attacked the economic system that Cuba has lived under for decades. And both of these leaders have called for negotiations anywhere, anytime, with any kind of agenda. You would think that this administration, the Obama administration, would look upon these extraordinary remarks as a siren to rush towards because they are so refreshing and possibly very rewarding. And it's not just words, but Cuba has taken a lot of actions in terms of liberalizing its sale of private land to private parties, to private ownership of houses, to limiting, to shrinking the state sector. There's been a lot of huge movements taking place. from Washington, not a peep. It's as if none of these things took place. And the reason for that is that Cuba has never been a foreign policy issue between the United States and Havana. It has always been a domestic policy issue centering on Miami. And this administration is rapidly chumming the waters and discarding its old positions of renovation and democratization because it doesn't want to be a one-term presidency. It wants a two-term presidency, and that's okay. But at a certain point, if you keep on cutting off yourself from issues and commitments that you yourself have made during the campaign and which attracted people to your campaign, you know, the question is, of what utility are these elections if they don't really decide issues?
Amen. That's a very important point in which we have to come to the end of the program, unfortunately. President Obama just appears to be like any other elected politician, and I believe probably in Latin America there were expectations for him like there were here that have gone unmet, to put it mildly. Larry Burns, Council of Hemispheric Affairs, I want to thank you again for another very entertaining program. I have to get back to you sooner than
Jeff, it was before. Wonderful. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Take care, very much. Take care.
Okay.
And again, that was Larry Burns, Council of Hemispheric Affairs. This is Jeff Blankford on Takes on the World. Next Wednesday, I'll be back here. It'll be open lines for you to give your takes on the world. 2 weeks from now, Joy LeClaire will have some guests talking about the nuclear situation, which I know you will all want to tune in. And I will announce her guests on my next program. So thank you all for listening. Tune in next week for, again, Takes on the World, and to give your takes on the world with open lines. You've been listening to this program on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willis and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg.